Yeah. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to another interview. I'm here with Caleb Maupin, and today we're going to talk about Stalin. Now, I've done a number of things on Stalin on this channel. One where I started reading around and asking the question, have we been lied to about Stalin? I did an interview with Grover Fur. I think we may have touched on it last time we talked as well. So I've got a number of things on Stalin that you can check out. They had some pretty big views, those videos. And it remains a topic of interest because as somebody who's interested in the mechanisms of power, as somebody who's interested in history, Stalin is just a towering figure of the 20th century, whichever way you look at it, whether you love him or hate him or, you know, whatever else, he's just a very important person, I think, to get right, to understand what he was about, to understand what was actually happening there. Before we get onto it, I'll just remind people, pick up a course at the Academic Agency, Trivium, many other courses, Foundations of Shakespeare, Economics, many other things there. Caleb, where can people find you?
Sure. My work is at CalebMaupinBooks.net, or you can check out my organization, the Center for Political Innovation, CPIUSA.org.
All right. So I don't know. I mean, I'll just touch on some of the stuff I've been interested in with Stalin. One of the really interesting things that I found looking at him, I mean, yeah, there was the lies of Khrushchev, the amount of stuff that is just is not, you know, there's not documentary evidence for a lot of the claims made about him. But I've also been interested in, I'll let you come in a second. In elite theory, there's this thing called the high-low-middle mechanism, okay? And I actually went and bought Stalin's own writings. They were published, like, by Moscow Press in the 70s, and I've got basically everything, like all of his key essays in two different books. I've got them over here. And I started reading through them. And one of the concepts I was really interested in was his notion of a kind of, I can't remember what he called it, like revolution from below or democracy. Like he had this idea of using almost like these struggle sessions where the middle management layer, the commissars and so on, would almost be kind of put in, like they had these criticism sessions where the workers and where people would then be given the floor to voice their criticisms and they just had to take it. And if there was a problem, that lower level could actually have remit to go to Stalin, which I found really fascinating. Another fascinating thing is the fact that we think of Stalin as an all-powerful dictator, a totalitarian, so on. But actually, he had a constant struggle with the middle layer of bureaucracy, right? He was always trying to make things more efficient, and he was always trying to take direct action and things like this. And there was this big middle management bureaucracy layer. And for almost the entire time that Stalin was in power, there's a kind of give and take, push and pull, you know, fight with this middle layer. And one way of thinking about Khrushchev and the Brezhnev era and so on is actually the final victory of that bureaucracy against what Stalin was trying to do. That's become my understanding of it, but I'll let you take it from there.
Well, I guess in response to what you just pointed out there, this is a point that I have raised over and over again, right? What does democracy mean? Literally just means the rule of the people, right? And actually the Greeks meant it in kind of a negative sense, right? You know, they had a positive and a negative, like monarchy was the good king and tyranny was the bad king. Oligarchy was the good elite. Plutocracy was the bad elite. Republic was the good elected government. And then democracy was vulgar mob rule. It just means the rule of the people. If you look at the Soviet Union at the time Stalin was leading it, or today you look at Iran, or you look at Cuba, or you look at North Korea, these countries, they don't have anywhere near the level of freedom in terms of freedom of speech, freedom of association, et cetera, that we have in the West. But they are more democratic in one sense, in that those governments depend on a highly involved and engaged population, right? The Islamic Republic of Iran would not be in power for 1 minute if it wasn't for those Basij councils they have in the neighborhood of people who wake up every day and think, it is my job to enforce the Islamic revolution in my neighborhood and go out and carry out the will of the revolution. And in North Korea, they would not be in power for 1 day if there wasn't a huge population that wakes up every day and say, I'm carrying out Kim Il-sung and Kim Jong-un's will. I need to go around my neighborhood and make sure we're carrying out the revolution. These governments depend on a heavily involved and heavily engaged population to carry out their activities. Whereas our governments in the West, they don't want us involved at all. They want us, you know, smoking drugs or looking at porn or what, you know, they want us to just be on our own while they manage things for us and don't manage things. Let the corporations just do whatever they want. So in that sense, these governments are more democratic because the population is heavily involved. And what you're pointing to there with Stalin is that, yes, Stalin, the 5-year economic plans that he carried out and these, you know, these meetings that you're describing, the population was heavily, heavily involved in carrying these things out. Look, I wrote my book Khrushchevism because after Stalin died, Khrushchev got up and condemned Stalin before the entire world, and that confused and destroyed the global communist movement. And I wrote this book not just as a defense of Stalin against Khrushchev, but also an examination of why his defamation of Stalin destroyed the global communist movement and why that was so effective and how it fit in with this anti-totalitarianism, which has been a CIA obsession and et cetera. That's my work on it. But like the first thing, if you ever bring up Stalin, people just throw out a body count. Well, Stalin killed 100 gajillion million people, right? 50 million, 70 million, 80 million. The first question you need to ask is how? How did he kill them? And most people can't answer the question. You know, you'll get crickets. Well, he killed them. Well, how did he kill them? Well, those big numbers that you get, they come from famines, right? That there was a famine in the Ukraine. You do realize there were famines all the time before Stalin and industrialized the country, right? There were famines routinely. People died of malnutrition all the time when Russia was an agrarian, non-industrialized country. It's Stalin who brought tractors to the countryside and mechanized agriculture. It's Stalin who electrified the whole country and built the power plants. It's Stalin who built a modern educational system and wiped out illiteracy. So it's like you're blaming the guy who cured the famines for the famine. That doesn't make any sense, right? It's not logical, right? Stalin cured the famines. Maybe he could have done so more effectively. Hindsight is always 20/20, but like he got the country out of being a primitive agrarian society where there were, you know, famines all the time to being a country with a modern food system, to being fully industrialized, to having the world's largest hydroelectrical power plant, to having the world's largest steel industry. I mean, it's like Stalin took the USSR from being an impoverished country and made it an industrial superpower. And that's just something you're not allowed to say in American media, right? It's just communism just failed everywhere. Everyone just starved and was miserable. It's like, no, Russia went from being an impoverished country to being a superpower with central planning and 5-year plans. And that's like the elephant in the room. And so then if you ever bring that up, people say, well, at what cost? At what cost, right? Well, it didn't come at the cost that it came for the West because we industrialized over the course of 200 years of colonialism, of killing people in Africa, killing people in Latin America, dragging people to America in the transcontinental slave trade, starving people all over the place. Like the process of the West industrializing was genocidal and murderous all over the planet. And what Stalin did in Russia was only in Russia, right? They didn't have to colonize anyone to do what they did. The other thing is now then when you get past these big numbers that come from famine, 70 million, and it's like, wait a second, Stalin cured the famines. Then people start talking about, well, what about the gulags, right? What about that? Well, there's no question that in 1936, 1937, there was an episode of mass fear in the Soviet Union, where people turned in their neighbors, people were terrified that there was some kind of Nazi conspiracy within the government. And a lot of innocent people ended up going to gulags, and that was wrong. And Stalin ended up executing the guy who was the head of the secret police for that, Yezhov. And Stalin, they call it in Russia, Yezhov's terror. Yezhov is generally blamed for it. But regardless, it was largely the population that was traumatized and very afraid that kind of made that happen. And the basis of it is pretty believable, right? You know, Stalin has a great book called Mastering Bolshevism, where he says, look, the imperialists, the French, the Americans, the British, the Germans, they spy on each other and they spend millions of dollars spying on each other, wrecking each other, competing with each other. Is it really crazy to think that they would spy on us? And we're their enemy, right? We're an alternative economic system. You know, is it really crazy to think they might conspire within our government? And to some degree or other, there was Nazi penetration of the Soviet government. I mean, I think when the Second World War began, there was a top general who went over to the Nazi side. So the idea that there was Nazi penetration of the Soviet state, that there was sabotage, that there was, you know, something like that, that's not outrageous. You know, was Trotsky and were Zinoviev and the others, were they actually like on the payroll of Hitler and of Japan? I don't know. I think it's very possible, though. I think it's very, very possible. And I think that Trotsky, especially, you know, in the late 1930s, he was being boosted by fascists and he was a professional anti-communist and he wanted to be in power, right? And so was he knowingly working for them or not? Grover Fuhr maintains he was. I am not 100% convinced, but I'm not saying it wasn't possible. But the number of people that went to gulags in the Soviet Union is much lower than the rate of people that are in prison in the United States. And the other thing is the gulags were not death camps. Most people went to the gulag for a year or two and then they got let out, right? There were no gas chambers in the gulags, right? Everybody knows what Hitler did. Right. Hitler rounded up people on the basis of their race, put them on trains, took them to places and gassed them to death for nothing other than their race, being Jewish, being Roma, Gypsy or whatnot. No one can point to anything that Stalin did that is on that level. Right. They moved the population around on the basis of ethnicity during the war. And that's what saved millions of Jewish people in the Soviet Union from being captured by the Nazis and killed. And that was done, they had what they call the forced deportations. They talk about where like the Chechens were moved out of the regions they historically lived in because there was a pro-Nazi insurgency in the area and they wanted to go in and just get the job done. So they moved the people out of the area. This is all in the context of a war in which like 27 million people in the Soviet Union died. This is like a catastrophic war with death on a scale that we can't even imagine, a military situation where people moved around on the basis of their ethnicity. Yes, but I mean, you can't find anything that Stalin did that fits this genocidal, mass murdering dictator, you know, monster image we get in the West. It just doesn't line up. We have a guy who led a very authoritarian government in lifting Russia and the surrounding countries from absolute poverty to inventing space travel, to being fully electrified, to being a superpower like the world has never seen. And also, if you are an American, right? I know your audience is largely British, but, you know, and this probably applies to Britons as well. But if you're an American.
About a third American.
Yeah. Okay. If you're an American, you directly benefited from Stalin. And I'll tell you how, right? You know, if one thing we constantly hear our politicians talk about, those good paying jobs, remember those good paying jobs in industry, those good paying jobs that used to exist? Well, they weren't always good paying jobs. If you go back to the 1920s, the people who worked in the steel mills, the people who worked in the automobile factories were making about what fast food workers make now in America. The only reason that those good paying jobs were good jobs is because the industries, you know, steel, auto, meatpacking were unionized by Stalinists, by the Communist Party that was sponsored and aligned with the Soviet Union. The Flint sit-down strike of 1937, the 1934 strike wave. 1934 in America, you had a strike wave where you had a general strike in Seattle or in San Francisco that shut down the docks. You had a Teamsters strike in Minneapolis. You had the Auto Light strike in Toledo, Ohio. And you had South Carolina declaring a state of emergency and sharecroppers on strike all over the South. And in that context, the U.S. government and Roosevelt fearing being overthrown by people who wanted to replace him with a fascist dictatorship and also fearing a revolution, Roosevelt moved to legalize labor unions with the Wagner Act and you know, start hiring workers with the Works Progress Administration. That would not have happened if they were not aligned with one-fifth of the planet. The biggest strike wave in American history was in the 1870s. It was the railroad workers' strike, and it didn't win a damn thing, right? All that resulted from that is the USA built a network of armories all over the country so they could put down unrest more effectively. And it was way bigger. But in 1934, when there was that strike wave in the summer of 1934, the American government panicked and huge concessions were won. If anyone in your family was a meat packer or a steel worker or an auto worker, and you got those high wages that they got post-World War II, that came from industrial unions that were built by Stalin. That would never have happened if one-fifth of the planet wasn't being led by the Soviet Union. Another thing I will never forget is that, you know, I remember being in high school. I lived in a little town in Ohio. And, you know, they had all the old newspapers from my little tiny town in Ohio on microfilm. And so one day, one of my high school teachers brought me a printout of a microfilm from my little town's local newspaper in 1951. And the headline on my local town's newspaper was, "Take that, Uncle Joe," right? And it began with a quotation from Stalin. Stalin had said, "The way America treats black people is unacceptable. The American government is racist. The crimes against the black people are unacceptable." It began with that quotation. And the article was all about how the first black family in my town had bought a house. And so clearly Stalin was a liar. He didn't know what he was talking about. You know, that shows you how important Stalin was. There would not have been a civil rights movement in America without Stalin, right? When Emmett Till was killed, you know, the famous case of the young man from Chicago was visiting family in Mississippi, whistled at a white woman, was brutally killed. They took that picture of Emmett Till's mutilated body. The Soviet Union took that picture and sent it all over the world and said, "This is America, the land of freedom and democracy. This is what they do to black people." And it was only because of the Soviet Union and the way it embraced the black freedom struggle that the power structure in America was forced to start dealing with the issue of race. And, you know, the same year, 1951, the Soviet Union, as a permanent Security Council member, brought William L. Patterson, a black activist, to the United Nations, and he gave a speech called "We Charge Genocide," condemning the American government for crimes against black people. And the Communist Party of the United States, that was functioning as an illegal organization during these years, was illegal. You could go to jail for being a member, went door to door in every black neighborhood in America, handing out copies. This is an official UN speech. About the conditions of black people in America. The Soviet Union presented this to the world about America committing genocide. And door to door, I've met old communists who remember that, going door to door in black neighborhoods, handing out or selling copies of a United Nations speech by William L. Patterson. I mean, this is huge. So the impact that Stalin has had on your life, if you're an American, is massive. It's absolutely massive. The good paying jobs wouldn't have existed. The civil rights movement would never have happened. Like, it's massive. There are a few individuals who have that big of an impact on world history. Stalin led one-fifth of the planet and a mass movement that was aligned with him, the Communist International. And that movement dramatically changed the course of history.
If we can just go back through some of these things, I want to try to bring some of the objections, because obviously I've had a number of videos on Stalin now, and there's always somebody kind of trying to counter in the comments. So I want to try to bring some of these up. On the famine in Ukraine, I've got a book by Anna Strong here.
Yeah.
In fact, I've got several books written around that time. They're pretty hard to find. I actually had to dig pretty hard, and I'm resourceful, but that one was hard to find, the Anna Strong one. I've got one. I had to pay good money for it as well. But in there, she says, like, basically you have to understand that when they were making the collectivized farms, the people, the kulaks, or the people who had the farms there, they didn't want their land being taken from them. So they basically murdered all the livestock. They're literally killing chickens and cows and so on, and destroyed their... So he wanted to bring in tractors and things like that. But obviously they were using like old plows and things. They destroyed them all. So that one of the reasons that there was a famine that year, it wasn't the only reason, but it was greatly exacerbated by the fact that all of the capital stock, you might say, whether it was livestock or the actual equipment they were using, was destroyed. How true is that? How true is that claim from Anna Strong?
When it comes to the Ukraine stuff, there are so many layers of lying that go on. First of all, the narrative that you get from the Ukrainian side is that somehow this was a plot against Ukraine, right? That Stalin, he just hated Ukrainians on an ethnic level, you know, because he's Russian, but he wasn't Russian. He was Georgian, but let's not quibble about facts. And those Russians said, we're going to kill us some Ukrainians because we hate Ukraine, and starve them all to death. There was a famine all over the USSR. It wasn't just in Ukraine. Ukraine just happens to be an area where there's a lot of agriculture. It's like the breadbasket. But there was a famine in Moldova. There was a famine in other countries. So the idea that it was an intentionally aimed at Ukraine, that's a big part of the Ukrainian nationalist narrative. That just doesn't match the facts. There was a Ukraine. There was a famine all over the USSR. That's one thing. The second thing is what you pointed out, that Anna Louise Strong pointed out, it was like a civil war in the countryside. And that largely the Red Army was sent in to hold back the population. The local peasantry wanted to go and hang those kulaks from, you know, from a lamppost. You know, they wanted to go in and just exterminate them. They were furious. The peasantry was kind of carrying out the collectivization, and the Red Army was sent in to kind of hold back the population from just exterminate, killing the kulaks and taking their land and making it a kind of controlled kind of thing. And that's one thing that comes across in a lot of testimonies from people who were there, is that it was the population that was furious at the kulaks for, you know, burning their crops and killing their animals and such. And the Red Army coming in was kind of bringing a level of order so that it wasn't just, you know, mass slaughter. And that comes across as well. And that, you know, Trotsky makes the criticism, which maybe there's some truth in this, that Stalin zigzagged. During the 1920s, he was encouraging private farming, peasant, enrich yourself. They were kind of building up the kulaks as part of the new economic policy. And then very dramatically, they shifted towards you know, collectivization and building the collective farms. There may be something to that. Hindsight is always 20/20, you know. And if you look at how collectivization of agriculture and the building of collective farms was done in China and it was done in Cuba, it was done gradually. It wasn't done dramatically. But it appeared that in the 1920s, things had gotten so out of hand in the countryside. It was almost like dual power. These kulaks were not following the Soviet government, and that they shifted very dramatically to pushing collective farms. The other thing that's interesting that people don't realize, collective farms are not government farms. The Soviet Union had what they called state farms, and state farms was just like being a government employee. You went in, you got your wage at the end of the day. Collective farms sold their produce to the state, right? That's how the collective farm system works, is that, you know, they produce as much as they can and the government buys their wheat or grain or whatever at a fixed rate. You know, that's, they're kind of capitalist in that sense. They're like cooperatives, if you will, right? And that, you know, they try to produce as much as they can, and then the government gives them, you know, a rate for how much they produce. And so when people always noticed that, like, if you looked at a collective farm in the USSR, which was, there would be barely anything there because everything was going into producing as much as they could. Whereas state farms, the people were much more comfortable because they're just, hey, they clock in, they get their wage. And that's interesting. The other thing is that in Russia today, there is a collective farm that still exists that's run by the Communist Party, the Lenin Farms Cooperative. And it's they have strawberries. They produce the strawberries for Russia. And the presidential candidate for the Communist Party was actually the president, the CEO of the Lenin Farms Cooperative. And I actually got to meet him when I was there to cover the 2018 elections. And that was kind of interesting. And that this Lenin Farms Cooperative that exists in Russia, it is very much a holdover from the Soviet period. And they have like their own school that is like of higher quality than most of the schools in Russia. And it's actually kind of a prestigious thing. A lot of people would really like to work at the Lenin Farms Cooperative that's still around. So it's again, there's nuance to this, and that we are given such an over-the-top version of events that, again, there were famines all the time before Stalin. There were no, I mean, one thing that we often will hear, right? And again, we can't imagine the conditions these people were in. Let me just talk about this for a minute, right? This is a criticism of the left and the people that will defend, you know, the USSR. Sometimes they can be a little bit naive, but it's also a criticism of the standard narrative, which is demonization, right? The conditions that these folks were in that we can't even relate in any conceivable way. After the Bolsheviks took power, this is Stalin, this is Lenin, this is Trotsky, this is before Stalin became the leader. A couple days after the Bolsheviks took power, everyone was drinking and partying. They had alcohol parties celebrating the revolution. But the White Army was coming. The counter-revolution was coming. So what did the Bolsheviks do? They forcibly conscripted every adult male. They confiscated all the alcohol. And they instituted the death penalty for drinking alcohol. Now, I cannot imagine a situation where I would ever shoot somebody for drinking alcohol, right? I don't drink myself, whatever. But I cannot imagine a situation where you would implement the death penalty for drinking alcohol. But that's the conditions they were in. Millions of people died in the Russian Civil War when 15 different countries invaded.
That was Trotsky, wasn't it? Who led the Red Army. Yeah.
And the level of like authoritarian, rigid military discipline that they implemented. And we can't imagine the conditions these folks were in, right? And as you know, the left in the West, you know, you get this whole like, well, I like Lenin, I like Trotsky, but Stalin was a big, mean guy. No, Lenin and Trotsky were big, mean guys too, that killed lots of people and put lots of people before firing squads also. And the circumstances of the Russian Revolution, it was a kill or be killed situation where, you know, we can't even relate. What I take from the Soviet Union, this is what I take from it, is that a country that had been deeply impoverished, was in dire, desperate conditions, had a revolution, was invaded, had an ugly civil war where millions of people were dying, was blockaded, they couldn't get medicine. They came from that situation to being the country that invented space travel, to wiping out illiteracy and building a modern education system, to building the world's largest steel industry, the world's largest tractor manufacturing, the world's largest power plants, making films, the films of Sergei Eisenstein, the music of Shostakovich. They got from circumstances we can't even imagine to real solid accomplishments that the world couldn't ignore. That shows me that socialism and having a planned economy, it's not a big failure. Oh, it just doesn't work. Like we're all told, like if you look at what the Soviet Union achieved and what they were up against and what they were able to accomplish, the idea that, oh, we just have to have capitalism, human nature. That's such obvious bullshit. Right. And that's what I take from it. But I don't romanticize what these people went through. I don't pretend that these people didn't have to make decisions that I could never even imagine. Look, the Soviet Union, you know, during that Ukrainian famine, they sold wheat on the international markets. People didn't have food, and the wheat that they did have, they sold internationally. Why did they do that? So they could use that money to buy tractors to make sure they didn't have another famine again. But can you imagine having to make that decision? There's people in your country that are going to starve, but you have to buy mechanization to make sure that this doesn't happen again. So you have to let people in your country die. So you can get the materials to make sure that more people don't die next year. This is circumstances we can't even imagine, choices we can't even imagine. But the over the top character we've been given is false. But the romanticization is also kind of naive.
Yeah, there's a few other little things I want to get into, you know, and we have to get into the weeds a little bit here as well. Mm-hmm. My understanding of the NEP, the new economic policy that Lenin brought in, was that if Lenin hadn't have done that, the Soviet Union would have failed at that moment. Okay, so he had to bring in what is known as the NEP, the new economic policy. Bukharin, who later became the leader of the so-called right, you know, the right deviation under Stalin, he wanted to continue that. But Stalin's reason for zigzagging, as Trotsky said, for going back on that, is because he spotted in the way Bukharin and the NEP was going, basically the like creating the new bourgeoisie, the new, like if that had been allowed to go on, they would have reproduced the problem in the first place, i.e. reproducing capitalism within the Soviet Union. So my understanding is that the reason he went back on the NEP was like, look, it served its purpose. It was there to stabilize us in the short term. But the actual plan is to have the proletariat, you know, the dictatorship of the proletariat. And we can't do that if we're going to empower a new middle class, essentially. Is that correct?
It's more than that. I think if the Soviet Union had been at peace and not been threatened, what Bukharin advocated, which was we're going to just kind of let capitalism develop but build up our state industries at the same time, they might have been able to do that. But Stalin knew that they didn't have time, that the Nazis and there would be an invasion from the West. And the Sixth World Congress, right, 1928, is the turning point. That's when Stalin solidified his leadership, defeating the left opposition of Trotsky and the right opposition of Bukharin. And basically, Stalin announced the capitalist West is going to have an economic crisis, and that is going to motivate them to invade us. They are going to have a war with us. We have to build this country up and have this country ready to repel that invasion. And so we don't have time to just let capitalism develop while we gradually scrape off the top and build a state industry. We have to just mobilize to have the five-year economic plans. And the brilliance of Stalin. See, I almost think Stalin didn't get enough credit. You know, a lot of what we think of as Marxism-Leninism came from Stalin, right? That the Soviet system was the brilliant compromise, right? The Bolshevik leaders, Lenin, Trotsky, Zinoviev, they were all living in exile, writing all the books. Stalin was the guy on the ground who organized the organization, right? You know, the theoretical journal was called Iskra, the Spark, right? That was the theoretical journal that was illegal, that they all wrote all their articles for. But they had a daily newspaper called Pravda, which means truth. And Stalin was the editor of Pravda. And Pravda was mainly short articles that were what they called worker correspondence. So people saying, at my factory, the boss has made us work, you know, so many more hours. That's bullshit. You know, my relative just got shot in this war with, you know, with the Germans that we're not gaining anything from. And it was like short little like letters to the editor. They called them workers' correspondence. That's what made up the Pravda. And Pravda would be distributed in mass everywhere. And it was like a place for people to voice their grievances. And it was very popular in mass. And Stalin was the editor of that publication. That publication was how the Bolshevik movement communicated with the broad population, 60% of which was illiterate. Like one worker would read it to all the others. You know, I mean, Stalin was a mass organizer. He was from Georgia, right? From an impoverished, you know, nationality. And he went to seminary school. And the Bolshevik leaders were constantly attacking him for having a Christian approach, which I think is fascinating, right? That Trotsky was furious. Apparently, a lot of these people he recruited were not atheists, right? You know, they didn't understand that they had to be atheists to be communists. And that you know, Stalin, he was able to work with Muslims and Christians. He organized in Baku. He organized in Azerbaijan and Batumi. And all throughout, like, the Central Asia, like the southern USSR, Stalin is going around organizing strikes and protests. He was a mass organizer. I mean, he had a brilliant knowledge of how to work with people. And the system that he created was like a compromise, right? On the one hand, you had the radical, very liberal ideas of the Bolsheviks, you know, women's equality, we're trying to build a socialist society. On the other hand, you had this deeply conservative Russian peasantry, right? That was Orthodox. And Stalin created a hybrid. And the Soviet Union was a hybrid between the radical leftist ideas of the Bolshevik leaders and the deeply conservative Russian peasantry. And for example, they put, you know, Lenin's body in a mausoleum, and, you know, the icons are a tradition of the Russian Orthodox Church. They made Lenin an icon, right? And then, you know, women had equality with men. They could vote. They were leaders of the military. They worked. They had daycares that were created so women could work. You know, but at the same time, they glorified the Soviet family. They outlawed abortion. Stalin outlawed abortion. They outlawed homosexuality. And in fact, Stalin instituted a policy where if a woman gave birth to more than 10 children, she got a medal. That was one of the highest honors, to be a mother of the Soviet Union, meaning that you had more than 10 children. And they glorified the Soviet family. And if you look at the role that Stalin played, he was like a king. He was like, you know, he played the role that a czar had played in the previous system. He was the face of the system. And what did Stalin do? He went around rewarding people, right? That's basically what he did, is he spent his life going from factory to factory, from collective farm to collective farm, giving awards to people for working really, really hard. You know, and he was, it's like, you can imagine the Soviet Union being like one giant corporation. And he was the CEO who visited every workplace and handed out awards to people for working really, really hard all the time. And that's what he did, right? And his job was, he was the national celebrity, the face of the nation. And if you worked really, really hard in your factory and you produced so much, he would come to your factory and give you a special award and a cash bonus, right? And and I have met people, it was the achievement of their life when their grandfather got to meet Stalin, because they you know, worked so hard, they worked so many extra hours in the coal mine, or they, you know, and that's that model, that's what you call really existing socialism, real socialism, or Stalinism. That was like the Cold War model. It's very effective at taking countries that are underdeveloped, that don't have industrialization, don't have electricity, don't have paved roads, don't have a modern education system, and building them up. right? And getting them over that hurdle of industrialization, it's very, very effective, right? And you have a charismatic leader who's the CEO. You have five-year economic plans. You have collective farms that sell their goods to the state at a fixed rate. And that model, it made many countries industrialized. And I don't think just Marxist-Leninist. I think, you know, if you look at Iraq and Syria, Saddam Hussein, Assad, they were a similar kind of system. Gaddafi's Libya was a very similar kind of thing of this kind of like, we're going to have a state centrally planned economy to industrialize. After that, though, it starts to stagnate. After that, mm-hmm. you need the market for material goods, right? For the things that make mm-hmm. life fun. Like, state central planners shouldn't be designing clothing, right? You know, people need to vote with their dollars about what kind of clothes they want. You know, children's toys, video, like things that make life fun, hotels, restaurants, that kind of thing. Yes, you do need market incentive for, but you don't need market incentive to run a power plant. You just need somebody yeah. getting paid to clock in and clock out and make sure it works, right? And that's the Stalin model was very, very effective, and he pioneered it. And it wasn't what Lenin and Trotsky thought of. He thought of it himself because he knew his people. Right. This is the crazy thing. Leftists in America burn the American flag. We hate it. Stalin loved his people and his nation, and he knew them so well that he could take what the Bolsheviks had created and adjust it in a way that the people that he knew, that he had organized in every corner of that country, they could accept it. Right. That's how well he knew and loved his people. There was a rock band from the 1960s that played at Woodstock. They were called Country Joe and the Fish Band, right? Just some stoner hippie stuff. But why were they called that, Country Joe and the Fish? Because that their parents were communists, and Country Joe was Stalin. That was Stalin's nickname, Country Joe, because he was from the countryside. And the fish was Mao. It was Stalin and Mao, because the fish, Mao said, the masses are the water and the revolutionary is the fish. That Mao and Stalin, they were both mass organizers. They knew how to work with people, right? And that when the Soviet, when the Communist Party of the United States became what you might call Stalinized, it changed the way it approached people. It had a much more mass approach. Its literature was much more clear and coherent. They put forward very clear demands, and they moved the headquarters of the Communist Party when Stalin, you know, assumed leadership in 1928. Stalin had the Communist Party of the United States move its headquarters from New York City to Chicago. And in the Communist Party's 1932 book, Towards Soviet America, they say Chicago will be the capital of America, not New York City, because Chicago is an industrial city in the heartland. And one of the complaints about the Communist Party is they pointed out that its membership was largely immigrants, people that came from somewhere else, largely African-American. They always found a white dude to be the leader of it, right? They had William Z. Foster, who was an Irish Catholic from Philadelphia. They had Earl Browder, who they called the man from Kansas because he was from Kansas, an agricultural state. They had Gus Hall, a guy of Finnish descent who'd been an iron range worker in Minnesota. Stalin was always saying, if you want to build a serious communist movement, you can't look like some foreign conspiracy trying to direct things. You need to build a movement that the heartland, the bulk of the American people will accept, that is really just an expression of them. And, you know, under Stalin's leadership, the Communist Party of the United States really amplified the cult of Abraham Lincoln, right? And they built the Abraham Lincoln Brigade that went to fight in Spain. I am fascinated by a phenomenon in Russia. My next book that should be published in the next couple of weeks is going to be called Mystical Stalinism. Mystical Stalinism is a trend in Russia now of people who admire Stalin, but they don't see him as a communist. They see him as kind of a representation of the Russian people and their history. And that there's a whole trend of people in Russia who admire Stalin, seeing him in kind of Russian Orthodox and a spiritual way as an expression of the Russian people, of the Russian Empire kind of asserting itself against the West. You know, there's a lot of talk nowadays of geopolitics, civilizations of the sea versus civilizations of the land, right? And the understanding is that when civilizations on the land are besieged and conquered by civilizations of the sea, on the land, messianic figures kind of emerge that rally the people of the land to defend their land and build themselves up and repel the foreign invaders. And civilizations of the land are much more collective, where civilizations of the sea are much more individualist. And you have empires of the sea like the Roman Empire or the British Empire that are about controlling trade routes and having wealth be concentrated in mighty cities. But civilizations on the land, in order to hold land masses together, you have to build roads, you have to develop in order to hold civilizations together. And that when the civilizations of the land are besieged by the empires of the sea, figures emerge on the land to kind of lead the people of the land to repel the invaders and industrialize. And that's an understanding of Stalin that I think is fascinating. They call it mystical Stalinism. And that's what my next book that should be out pretty soon is going to be about.
Very interesting. I mean, just before we wrap up on this, my understanding was that Kalinin did a lot of that going around giving people's medals type stuff as well. That, you know, maybe if Stalin was not available, you might get Kalinin come into your town, give you a medal for hard work or reaching a quota or whatever else. I made a video a while back last year on the industrialization part, because I actually think that there is a heroic core, right? You imagine these people, the conditions, again, unimaginable for us, but, you know, they're carving whole new cities out of rock, okay? The industrial basis, not just the steel industry in Russia, but the infrastructure, the energy, you know, it's a gas powerhouse now and a oil powerhouse. All of the work that was required to do that happened in the 1940s. And in fact, I think when it came to energy policy, after Stalin, the same guy was in charge for like 30 odd years. They didn't touch that bit. But that is still the economy of Russia today. Putin's economy is built directly on top of what Stalin left for the country. There wouldn't be a Russia if it wasn't for what he did in that time. And, you know, one of the things that I find frustrating is that, you know, I make these points and people say, oh, well, the thing is, they brought in American help. They stole, you know, they copy the technology. They land lease gave. And I'm thinking, like, look, if you've ever played Sid Meier's Civilization, right, you've got another civilization that is ahead of you in tech. What are you going to do? You have to catch up. You have to get it from what they're going to just like reinvent the entire supply chain themselves. They're going to have to get, you know, if you're trying to get ahead, you have to get the technology from, you know, if it exists over there, it makes sense. We need the tractor now. Okay, we'll use American tech. Who cares? So I don't understand why that argument is always brought up as if it kind of takes away the achievement or lessens it in some way. How would you respond to that?
Well, first of all, they paid for it largely. That was what socialism in one country. Trotsky wanted just to be antagonistic towards the West and eventually march communism there. Stalin said, look, we have to make trade deals. And they paid for it. They hired General Electric to come help them build their power plants. They hired Ford to help them build their auto plants, right? And on top of that, the idea that somehow that means that they couldn't invent anything on their own, they invented space travel. The first person in space was Yuri Gagarin. The first satellite was Sputnik. So LED lights were invented in the Soviet Union, right? AK-47, which is like considered one of the most efficient weapons, that was invented in the Soviet Union. They were clearly capable of inventing things, but they were starting out at a lower level than the West. And so they hired the West to help them set up. I mean, I don't understand why that's an argument against them. And it clearly, I mean, if people are inferring from that they were incapable of inventing things, 1981, the Soviet Union had a home computer system. They invented their own home computer system, completely different than you know, Western technology, with nothing like IBM and Apple. But they just didn't mass produce it. They didn't have the resources to have everyone have it in their home, but they developed one. You can look at it. I mean, they were able to have technological advancement. There was the treaty on multilateral technology controls that was implemented, where all the NATO countries basically said you cannot give what they call high technology to the USSR. And that was a big part of the Cold War, is that, yeah, during the 20s and 30s, the Soviet Union had hired a lot of Western technicians to come in. But starting in after World War II, that was a big policy of the NATO countries, was don't let them get any technology. So that's kind of interesting. The other thing is, you talk about the oil industry. You know who one of the main architects of the Soviet oil industry was? That was Fred Koch, the father of the Koch brothers, right? The Koch brothers. Yeah, he had invented a method of thermal cracking, of turning oil, petroleum, into gasoline, right? And he was sued by all the major oil companies in America. They wanted to put him out of business because he had copyrighted it and it was more efficient. And he was basically, the capitalist system had bankrupted him, basically. He couldn't function because he was so good at it. He was kind of an Ayn Rand, you know, kind of figure. But luckily, there was a guy named Stalin who hired him, and he spent, you know, 20, 30 years in the USSR building Stalin's oil industry. He was impressed with the Soviet system. He was also terrified of it. And he came back to the United States, and his sons are these big right wingers and big anti-communists, because they saw how efficient communism was and how it very well could displace the West. It's kind of interesting to think about. But yeah, the Koch brothers' dad was hired to run the Soviet oil industry.
But last thing we have to get to, I have to remember to come back to it. You mentioned the gulags earlier on and the purges, okay? I mean, again, people who want to kind of paint Stalin as a monster would say, well, look, it was pretty simple. I mean, he had Yagoda was there first, right? And the story is Yagoda was not zealous enough. He was too sluggish in his purges. So they brought in this other guy. What was his name, the replacement?
Yezhov.
Yeah, they brought in Yezhov. Then he was got a bit too carried away. Okay, and then Beria kind of had him investigated and, you know, sewed it all up. A kind of reading that paints Stalin as a monster was that Stalin was that each one of those things was Stalin's decision, and, you know, the claim that Beria's report and all the rest of it, the claim that Yezhov had gone too far and so on, was just a kind of inter-Soviet cover-up on behalf of the Stalinists. How would you respond to this sort of reading that, you know?
Well, this is, again, Khrushchevism, this narrative of the big evil man, right? The big evil man, the evil genius of one man, right? That somebody is clearly just motivated by pure maniacal self-gain. And, you know, it's like, you could do that to anybody, right? You could go through anyone's life and choose to interpret every event as a sinister scheme to gain power or something, right? If you can do that to anybody, but that's a big part of what Khrushchev did with his speech condemning cult of personality and its consequences. And that really that's an Oedipal narrative, right? That's a child who wants to kill their father, right? That's a teenager rebelling against their father, who sees their father as this all-powerful tyrant, and they want to tear him down. And leftism as a movement appeals to the Oedipal thing. I mean, that's really, and that's, again, there's another text that I quote a lot called Freud and Marx, A Dialectical Study. There's another one called The Psychology of Reaction, both by Reuben Osborne. And they talk about how during the Stalin years, there was an effort to change the way leftism appeals. Leftism's appeal is largely libidinal, letting people unleash their rage, letting people unleash their sexual impulses, their anger, and Oedipal, the desire of a teenager to kill their parent, you know, to assert their independence. And that under Stalin's leadership in the 1930s, the appeal of the communist movement kind of shifted to more like appealing to people's loyalty to their country, to their homeland, feelings of community, etc. And that the reason narratives like that really hit home among the left is a lot of leftists are motivated. They want to kill their parents, right? So you present Stalin as like you go through every decision he made and it was all a secret plot, right? Look, they have spent, this is an interesting fact, they have spent millions of dollars. The Russian Studies Department at Yale has spent millions of dollars trying to make the case that the purges that happened, right, the Great Terror, it was sparked by the murder of Sergei Kirov. A Soviet official named Sergei Kirov was assassinated. They have spent millions of dollars trying to prove that Stalin killed Kirov because it was all a plot for him to take over. It was the Reichstag fire or whatever. They can't prove that. They really want that to be true, though. They really, really want that to be true, that Stalin killed Kirov himself so that everyone would panic and then he could purge everybody. There's absolutely no evidence of that. There's no evidence whatsoever that Stalin personally killed Kirov and knocked him off so that he could make everyone panic and have the Great Terror. They want that to be true because it fits a narrative, right? It fits a narrative of Stalin, the evil controlling man at the top. No, Sergei Kirov was killed. The guy who killed him was somebody. They went over his history with somebody with like mental health concerns. There probably was some kind of wider conspiracy, but he was a patsy. He was somebody they kind of got to go do it. But the idea that Stalin did it himself, I mean, that there's just no way. I mean, they've spent so much money trying to prove that. And there are some like very silly, not credible books that claim that, but there's really no evidence that Stalin killed Kirov himself. but they want that to be true. That kind of goes to show you how important this narrative is. And again, this is that as Cold War kind of liberal anti-communism was developing, books like Eric Hoffer's book, The True Believer, were widely circulated. Books like the CIA book, the anti-communist book, The God That Failed. Mm-hmm. It stopped being that communism was atheistic and godless and against everything Western. It started being, well, communism is just an example of a mass movement. Communism is a lot like fascism. It's a lot like Christianity. It's a lot like all these things that are mass movements that suppress the individual and want us to not think for ourselves. They're always very, very dangerous. And that became the Western liberal narrative, right? The philosophical irrationalist and postmodern narrative. It's against communism because it sees communism as an expression of human beings coming together and organizing in a collective way and threatens individuality. And that's very much, and this kind of narrative that you're getting, that's a liberal trope, right? Because if you look throughout history, human beings are collective creatures. Everything we've accomplished has been collective. But the way the liberal order can maintain its power is making sure that mass movements where people come together and work together don't happen. I mean, even Julius Evola talks a lot about the organic state. If you read Man Among Ruins, where, you know, this is the natural form. People form mass movements that have leaders, right? Every classroom has a teacher, right? Every church has a priest or a minister leading it, right? You know, I mean, and this every country in history has had a head of state, even if they have a parliament or what, they still had a head of state figure. This is something we do. But breaking that down and causing us to be endlessly suspicious of this is part of the liberal order's mind fuck.
Yeah. Last thing, because I don't know, we have to wrap up. One of the things Grover Fuhr mentioned when I talked to him, and one of the things he mentions in his books, is that if you actually have a look at the gulags, they weren't that much worse, or they were kind of on par with British prisons or American prisons at the time, right? What do you make of that argument? Is that, do you think he's going a bit far there? Because one of the comments that I guarantee you, somebody will just write, read Solzhenitsyn, okay? And one of the things that actually got me on this track was seeing that the source for many of the stats is Robert Conquest, okay? And the thing that got me onto Grover Fuhr was the fact that one of Robert Conquest's claims was that 5% of the entire Soviet population was sent to the gulag.
That's ridiculous.
And I was, well, how did Robert Conquest come up with this figure? And literally, he'd just gone and interviewed someone, and then, oh, how many people do you think it was? That person said, oh, 5% maybe, and then he writes it down. And then the fact that Conquest writes it down is then reproduced everywhere else, and that becomes the stat. Which is like, well, this is not empirical in any single way. This is an anecdote. So anyway, yeah, what do you make of Fuhr's claim that the gulag was not that much worse than prison conditions anywhere else at the time?
Well, I deeply respect Grover. He's a friend, and I appreciate a lot of his work. I just don't know enough, and I wouldn't be comfortable making that claim. My feeling when I think about like what I said before about how they were, you know, they were executing people at one point for drinking alcohol. And my understanding of Soviet society is that it was a very, very authoritarian place. And that, you know, I'm just not comfortable going, you know, where he's going there. I know a lot of people. Look, according to even Grover and even some of the most sympathetic to Stalin sources, a lot of innocent people went to gulags during the mass terror of 1937. A lot of people shouldn't have been there. A lot of people were executed who shouldn't have been executed, and everyone admits that. So I don't feel a need to argue about that. As far as the sloppy scholarship, I want to say this. There's a book that was widely circulated. It's still widely circulated, called Mao, The Unknown Story, a biography of Mao that was considered, oh, this is the big biography of Mao. And you read that book, it is ridiculous. And it's the same kind of thing. For example, one of the claims in the book is that like one of the most epic, important battles of Chinese history is, you know, during the Civil War, there was a bridge that was like held over a river by chains, and the enemy like burned the bridge, so only the chains were there. And the Red Army soldiers like went over the bridge, like, you know, with the chains, you know, had to go through under fire, right? And that's like an epic moment in Chinese history. This book that is the most widely, it's the Mao biography in America, says that battle never happened. And the source on it is, the author says she met a woman near the battle site who sold noodles, and she told her the battle never happened. And it's like, are you like, could you imagine someone writing a book and saying the Battle of the Alamo never happened? And their source is, well, I talked to somebody and he said his grandfather. No, that's ridiculous. Or saying that like the Battle of Gettysburg or the Battle of Waterloo just never happened. And then it being published and millions of Americans opening it and saying, wow, this epic battle in Chinese history never happened. Like, you can't make a claim like that and not back it up. I mean, yes, historical revisionism and people, I mean, these things do happen, but you have to prove it. But if it's Mao or it's Stalin, everyone knows they're bad. What, are you saying Mao was good? Are you saying Stalin was good? You know, you can just say anything, right? And that's you know, that's the way Western media is. It's like you create a dichotomy where, you know, I mean, and it's like, and the other thing that's weird about this is Holocaust revisionism, right? I am increasingly suspicious of it because I've noticed they've made Holocaust revisionism the go-to. If you ever question anything that they say about a country, it's like, oh, I bet you're going to say the Holocaust didn't happen, you know? And it's like, well, the Holocaust happened like in the 1940s, right? We're talking like hundreds of years ago. This is not like a current event in the news. Like, I, you know, but that's like the go-to point. Oh, I bet you're going to, they go to that. They've made the Holocaust revisionism kind of the poster boy for questioning any allegation of atrocities, basically, in American minds. And it's like, I have to be careful the language I use when I'm talking about Stalin, right? I don't use certain phrases, because if I use them, the audience will hear that and it'll ring a bell for Holocaust denial in their heads, and they immediately have a block and they don't listen. And that's very interesting to me. And there's that documentary Defamation, I don't know if you've seen it, that talks about how Israel amplifies Holocaust denial because it feeds their narrative. Right. And that they like are desperate to find Holocaust denial and Holocaust revisionism because it feeds the narrative of Israel. And I'm very suspicious. And, you know, we've all the narrative around the Holocaust that we've gotten. So I guess the narrative that most people grew up with, right, you know, in like the Cold War years was that like the Holocaust was an example of totalitarianism. Right. Communism is the extreme left. And fascism is the extreme right, and they're both kind of the same, and mass crimes happen when you're an extremist. That was kind of the Cold War narrative, right? The narrative that I got in the 90s was that the Holocaust happened because the USA doesn't invade countries, right? That's the narrative that we got, right? You know, we yeah, read Ely Wiesel and all this, and it's like, if only America had regime-changed Hitler in 1933, the Holocaust would never have happened. And that is, first of all, that's so historically wrong. I don't even know where to begin. I mean, that's just not the relationship the USA had with Germany. And there's so many layers to that that are just wrong. But like you're not allowed. You know, the Holocaust denier, people that are critical of the Holocaust, like that guy in Britain, right? They are like the bad example. And anyone who questions any claim about any leader anywhere in the world, well, you're just like those Holocaust deniers. It's very, very strange. It's very, very, very strange.
Well, it's not just on historical revisionism. It is the logic for basically all claims, right? I mean, it's basically structurally identical to, I mean, we saw this language during COVID as an example. We saw this language, you know, around climate change. We see this language around so many, where we even saw this language around people who thought that there was something up with the 2020 election. It's the word denier, right? That is that is a structural logic. And you're right. It's the example, right? It's the example, but it means that automatically, if you question anything, you put in that box or something like this, right? So. Yeah. Yeah, very, very, very interesting. All right. Well, we went a bit longer than I planned on this one, but Stalin's a huge topic, obviously. Where can people find you, Caleb?
My organization is the Center for Political Innovation, CPIUSA.org, and my personal website is CalebMoppinBooks.net.
And I'll just remind people, you can buy courses at the Academic Agency, Trivium, the bestseller there. I'll catch you all next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the Academic Agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium
to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.